This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 2, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 1, How the Great Wind Came to Beacon House. Part 2. "Quite so," assented Dr. Warner stolidly. "Insanity is generally incurable." "So is sanity," said the Irishman, and studied him with a dreary eye. "Symptoms?" asked the doctor. "What was this telegram?" "It's a shame to joke about such things," said Inglewood, in his honest, embarrassed way. "The telegram was Smith's illness, not Smith. The actual words were, 'Man found alive with two legs.'" "Alive with two legs," repeated Michael, frowning. "Perhaps a version of alive and kicking? I don't know much about people out of their senses, but I suppose they ought to be kicking." "And people in their senses?" asked Dr. Warner, smiling. "Oh, they ought to be kicked," said Michael, with a sudden heartiness. "The message is clearly insane," continued the impenetrable Warner. "The best test is a reference to the undeveloped normal type. Even a baby does not expect to find a man with three legs." "Three legs," said Michael Moon, "would be very convenient in this wind." A fresh eruption of the atmosphere had indeed almost thrown them off their balance and broken the blackened trees in the garden beyond. All sorts of accidental objects could be seen scouring the wind-scoured sky: straws, sticks, rags, papers, and, in the distance, a disappearing hat. Its disappearance, however, was not final. After an interval of minutes, they saw it again, much larger and closer, like a white Panama towering up into the heavens, like a balloon staggering to and fro for an instant, like a stricken kite, and then settling in the center of their own lawn as falteringly as a dead leaf. "Somebody's lost a good hat," said Dr. Warner shortly. Almost as he spoke, another object came over the garden wall, flying after the fluttering Panama. It was a big green umbrella. After that came hurtling a huge yellow Gladstone bag, and after that a figure like a flying wheel of legs, as in the shield of the Isle of Man. But though for a flash it seemed to have five or six legs, it alighted upon two, like the man in the queer telegram. It took the form of a large, light-haired man in gay green holiday clothes. He had bright blonde hair, and the wind brushed back like a German's a flushed, eager face like a cherub's, and a prominent, pointing nose, a little like a dog's. His head, however, was by no means cherubic in the sense of being without a body. On the contrary, on his vast shoulders and shape, generally gigantesque, his head looked oddly and unnaturally small. This gave rise to a scientific theory, which his conduct fully supported, that he was an idiot. Inglewood had a politeness, instinctive and yet awkward. His life was full of arrested half-gestures of assistance, and even this prodigy of a big man in green, leaping the wall like a bright green grasshopper, did not paralyze that small altruism of his habits in such a matter as a lost hat. He was stepping forward to recover the green gentleman's headgear, when he was struck rigid with a roar like a bull's. "Unsportsmanlike," bellowed the big man. "Give it fair play, give it fair play." And he came after his own hat quickly, but cautiously, with burning eyes. The hat had seemed at first to droop and dawdle, as in ostentatious languor on the sunny lawn. But the wind again freshened, and rising, it went dancing down the garden with the devilry of a pas de quatre. The eccentric went bounding after it with kangaroo leaps and bursts of breathless speech, of which it was not always easy to pick up the thread. "Fair play, fair play. Sportive kings chase their crowns. Quite humane. Tramontana. Cardinals chase red hats. Old English hunting. Started a hat in Brambercombe. Hat at bay. Mangled hounds. Got him." As the wind rose out of a roar into a shriek, he leapt into the sky on his strong, fantastic legs, snatched at the vanishing hat, missed it, and pitched sprawling, face foremost, on the grass. The hat rose over him like a bird in triumph, but its triumph was premature, for the lunatic flung upward on his hands, threw up his boots behind, waved his two legs in the air like symbolic ensigns, so that they actually thought again of the telegram, and actually caught the hat with his feet. A prolonged and piercing yell of wind split the welkin from end to end. The eyes of all the men were blinded by the invisible blast as by a strange, clear cataract of transparency rushing between them and all objects about them. But as the large man fell back in a sitting position and solemnly crowned himself with the hat, Michael found to his incredulous surprise that he had been holding his breath like a man watching a duel. While that tall wind was at the top of its sky-scraping energy, another short cry was heard, beginning very querulous, but ending very quick, swallowed in abrupt silence. The shiny black cylinder of Dr. Warner's official hat sailed off his head in the long, smooth parabola of an airship, and in almost cresting a garden tree was caught in the topmost branches. Another hat was gone. Those in that garden felt themselves caught in an unaccustomed eddy of things happening. No one seemed to know what would blow away next. Before they could speculate, the cheering and hallooing hat-hunter was already halfway up the tree, swinging himself from fork to fork with his strong, bent grasshopper legs, and still giving forth his gasping, mysterious comments. Tree of life, Yggdrasil, climbed for centuries, perhaps. Owls nesting in the hat, remotest generation of owls, still usurpers. Gone to heaven, man in the moon wears it. Brigand, not yours. Belongs to depressed medical man in garden. Give it up, give it up. The tree swung and swept and thrashed to and fro in the thundering wind like a thistle, and flamed in the full sunshine like a bonfire. The green, fantastic human figure, vivid against its autumn red and gold, was already among its highest and craziest branches, which by bare luck did not break with the weight of his big body. He was up there among the last tossing leaves and the first twinkling stars of evening. Still talking to himself cheerfully, reasoningly, half-apologetically in little gasps, he might well be out of breath, for his whole preposterous raid had gone with one rush. He had bounded the wall once like a football, swept down the garden like a slide, and shot up the tree like a rocket. The other three men seemed buried under incident piled on incident, a wild world where one thing began before another thing left off. All three had the first thought. The tree had been there for the 5 years they had known the boarding house. Each one of them was active and strong. No one of them had even thought of climbing it. Beyond that, Inglewood felt first the mere fact of colour, the bright, brisk leaves, the bleak blue sky, the wild green arms and legs, reminded him irrationally of something glowing in his infancy, something akin to a gaudy man on a golden tree. Perhaps it was only a painted monkey on a stick. Oddly enough, Michael Moon, though more of a humorist, was touched on a tenderer nerve. Half remembered the old young theatricals with Rosamond, and was amused to find himself almost quoting Shakespeare. For valour, is not love Hercules still climbing trees in the Hesperides? Even the immovable man of science had a bright, bewildered sensation that the time machine had given a great jerk and gone forward with a rather rattling rapidity. He was not, however, wholly prepared for what happened next. The man in green, riding the frail topmost bough like a witch on a very risky broomstick, reached up and rent the black hat from its airy nest of twigs. It had been broken across a heavy bough in the first burst of its passage. A tangle of branches had torn and scored and scratched it in every direction. A clap of wind and foliage had flattened it like a concertina. Nor can it be said that the obliging gentleman with the sharp nose showed any adequate tenderness for its structure when he finally unhooked it from its place. When he had found it, however, his proceedings were by some counted singular. He waved it with a loud whoop of triumph, and then immediately appeared to fall backwards off the tree, to which, however, he remained attached by his long, strong legs, like a monkey swung by his tail. Hanging thus head downward above the unhelmeted Warner, he gravely proceeded to drop the battered silk cylinder upon his brows. "Every man a king," explained the inverted philosopher. "Every hat, consequently, a crown. But this is a crown of heaven." And he again attempted the coronation of Warner, who, however, moved away with great abruptness from the hovering diadem, not seeming, strangely enough, to wish for his former decoration in its present state. "Wrong, wrong," cried the obliging person hilariously. "Always wear a uniform, even if it's a shabby uniform. Ritualist may always be untidy. Go to a dance with soot on your shirt front, but go with a shirt front. Huntsman wears old coat, but old pink coat. Wear a topper, even if it's got no top. It's the symbol that counts, old cock. Take your hat, because it is your hat after all. It's nap rubbed all off by the bark, dears, and its brim not the least bit curled, but for old sake's sake, it is still, dears, the nobbiest tile in the world." Speaking thus with wild comfortableness, he settled or smashed the shapeless silk hat over the face of the disturbed physician, and fell on his feet among the other men, still talking, beaming, and breathless. "Why don't they make more games out of the wind?" he asked in some excitement. "Kites are all right, but why should it only be kites? Why, I thought of three other games for a windy day while I was climbing that tree. Here's one of them. You take a lot of pepper." "I think," interposed Moon with sardonic mildness, "that your games are already sufficiently interesting. Are you, may I ask, a professional acrobat on tour, or a travelling advertisement of Sunny Jim? How and why do you display all this energy for clearing walls and climbing trees in our melancholy but at least rational suburbs?" The stranger, so far as so loud a person was capable of it, appeared to grow confidential. "Well, it's a trick of my own," he confessed candidly. "I do it by having two legs." Arthur Inglewood, who had shrunk into the background of this scene of folly, started and stared at the newcomer with his short-sighted eyes screwed up and his high color slightly heightened. "Why, I believe you're Smith," he cried with his fresh, almost boyish voice, and then, after an instant's stare, "and yet I'm not sure." "I have a card, I think," said the unknown with a baffling solemnity, "a card with my real name, my titles, offices, and true purpose on this earth." He drew out slowly from an upper waistcoat pocket a scarlet card case, and as slowly produced a very large card. Even in the instant of its production, they fancied it was of a queer shape, unlike the card of ordinary gentlemen. But it was there only for an instant, for as it passed from his fingers to Arthur's, one or another slipped his hold. The strident, tearing gale in that garden carried away the stranger's card to join the wild waste-paper of the universe, and that great western wind shook the whole house and passed. End of chapter 1.